Welcome, and thank you all for standing by. All participants will be on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's call. At that time, you can press star one to ask a question from the phone lines. I'd also like to inform parties that the call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'll now turn the meeting over to Mr. Brady Phillips. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you, Sarah, and good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining for this monthly climate call, which is part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to governments, businesses, academia, and the public to help support informed decision-making. Again, I'm Brady Phillips with NOAA's Office of Communications in Washington, and I'll be facilitating the call today. But during the call, we'll have three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. We'll be following along with a presentation, a PowerPoint, that you can download at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings, that's B-R-I-E-F-I-N-G-S. First presenter is Jay Crouch, a climate scientist at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. We'll provide a summary of the July U.S. and global climate reports and the drought monitor released earlier today. Our next presenter is Kathy Dello, an associate director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute, located at Oregon State University. And the final presenter today is Anthony Artusa, a meteorologist and seasonal forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will give us the latest El Nino forecast, as well as the monthly seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks for the coming 3 months. Our first speaker will be Jake Crouch from NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. Jake?
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to start speaking to slide number 2 on the slide decks you can download from our website. In a report that was just released, July 2017, for the Global Land and Ocean Services ranked as the second warmest July on record, and that temperature departure from average was 0.83 degrees Celsius above average. This was cooler than the temperatures we saw in July 2016. July 2017 was the 47th consecutive July and 391st consecutive month with temperatures above the 20th century average. Looking at land and ocean surfaces separately, the land surface temperature during July 2017 was record warm at 1.2 degrees Celsius above average, and the ocean surface ranked as the third warmest July on record at 0.69 degrees Celsius above average. The map on the right shows how temperatures broke down during the month of July. We saw significant warmth across most areas of the globe, with record warmth across Africa, parts of the Indian Ocean, large parts of Australia, and scattered across the Middle East and parts of Asia. We did see below-average temperatures across eastern Canada stretching into the North Atlantic, as well as across much of Russia and Siberia. A couple of national statistics, Bahrain saw its warmest July on record and subsequently its warmest month ever on record for that nation. Australia had its third warmest July and its warmest since 1975. Here in the U.S., Alaska saw its third warmest July as well, with many locations including Barrow and Bettles setting all-time high temperature records during the month. Moving to slide number 3, this is our horse race graphic showing year-to-date temperatures as you move from left to right. 2017 is in the black line. 2016, which is our warmest year on record, is in the red at the top. So we can see that 2017 so far in the year has been trending below temperatures we saw in 2016. And for the January through July period, we're still ranked the second warmest. We can see here a couple of scenarios running out the rest of the year, looking at temperatures for August through December. The top scenario running through the rest of the year would be if we saw temperature departures from average of about 0.85 degrees Celsius. So this would be temperatures ranking among the warmest or second warmest for those given months, August through December. If we do have that situation occur, 2017 would ultimately rank as the third warmest year on record in the NOAA data set. We see a cooler scenario there with temperatures tying what we saw in 1998, which would be quite a bit cooler than what we've seen so far this year, and it seems to be unlikely. And even in that situation, we would still be tied at third warmest. So looking at the temperatures we've seen so far this year and potential scenarios going forward, 2017 will likely rank as the third warmest year on record for the globe, with the four warmest years on record all occurring in the last 4 years. Moving on to slide number four to talk about what happened here in the U.S. during July. The average temperature for the lower 48 was 2.1 degrees above average, and this was the 10th warmest July on record. A lot of the warmth that we saw during the month was across the western U.S., as well as parts of the south and the southeast. We did see record warmth across many locations in the west. Reno, Salt Lake City, and Bakersfield, California all saw their warmest July and warmest month of any month on record. And also in the southeast, Miami was record warm, and it was also the warmest month ever observed in the city. We did see below-average temperatures across parts of the Midwest and Northeast, and those locations also saw above-average precipitation. The above-average precipitation lowered or suppressed daytime highs during July, which led to those near and below-average temperatures during the month. We did see below-average precipitation as well across the Northwest, stretching through the Northern Rockies and into the Northern Plains and Upper Midwest. And an active monsoon season in the southwest led to above-average precipitation in that part of the country. The wetness and the dryness nearly averaged out during the month, and it was a near-average July overall for the contiguous U.S. Moving on to slide number five to look at year-to-date temperature and precipitation for the U.S. For the first 7 months of the year, the temperature for the lower 48 was 3.2 degrees Fahrenheit above average, and this has been our second warmest year-to-date on record, with 2012 remaining the record holder for that seven-month period. We did see much above average and record warmth across a large part of the contiguous U.S., with record warmth stretching across the southwest and into the southern plains, as well as the southeast. Florida, North Carolina, and South Carolina have all seen their warmest year-to-date on record. We did see below average temperatures across parts of the northwest, particularly in western Washington. Looking at precipitation, it's been a fairly wet year for the lower 48, ranking as the seventh warmest January through July on record. We saw significantly above average precipitation across large areas of the west. A lot of that precipitation fell earlier in the year and is still showing up on our year-to-date maps. We did see above average and record precipitation across parts of the central Rockies and central high plains, as well as the Midwest, Northeast, and the deep south. And in the middle of all of that, we did see the below-average precipitation across the northern plains, which has been dealing with significant drought for several months now, with numerous crop failures due to the lack of precipitation and high temperatures. Moving on to slide number six to speak to the U.S. Drought Monitor report that was released this morning. 11.3% of the lower 48 is in drought, and this is up about 3.3% since late June. We did see some drought improvement, though. Parts of the southwest saw drought improvement with that increased monsoonal flow and precipitation. And parts of the southern and northern plains also saw drought improvement. In the northern plains, which continues to be gripped by drought, we did see some areas receive heavy precipitation earlier in August, which did provide some drought relief, but it's a little late for many of the crops to recover this late in the summer season. We did see drought worsen across the northwest, with heat and lack of precipitation causing abnormally dry conditions to expand into Washington and Oregon. And we saw the drought intensify and expand across the northern Rockies and plains and into the parts of the Midwest. And outside of the contiguous U.S., we did see drought improvement across Alaska, but drought expanded and intensified in parts of Hawaii and Puerto Rico. And with that, I will pass it off to Kathy.
Great. Thank you, Jake. Good morning, everybody, from the cloudy Willamette Valley. We're 5 days out from the eclipse, and we're certainly worried it will be like this on Monday. But here in the Pacific Northwest, we've had a pretty rough start to the month. We've seen intense heat and big wildfires, in part due to some of these wildfires that were burning up in British Columbia. We saw the smoke travel down into Seattle, Portland, and parts of the Willamette Valley. And Oregon and Washington also have a number of acres that are on fire right now. Jake just showed a graphic that shows our year-to-date precipitation as above average. And really, here in the Northwest, our 2017, we've turned it up to 11 in terms of climate. Our winter was relatively cool, snowy, very wet. Our spring was wet, and now our summer is hot and dry. I'm going to move on to slide number eight. And this is just the peak of our heat wave that occurred earlier this month. And we broke all sorts of daily station records. All-time station records were threatened, but none of them fell. But Seattle rarely reaches 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and they got close. Both Portland, Corvallis, Eugene, and Medford were all over 100 during some of these days. So the heat here in the Northwest is difficult for many of us. We don't have air conditioning everywhere like other parts of the country, and we're certainly not acclimated to it. So temperatures over 100, regardless of it being a dry heat, are often difficult for sensitive groups. Moving on to slide number 9, when we peek under the hood of the year-to-date precipitation, like I said, we had a really wet spring and winter, but the last 60 days have been dry. So that's why that D0 shows up on the U.S. Drought Monitor for most of Washington and Oregon. And you'll see that parts of the state, especially southern Oregon, that may be some monsoonal influence, and north central Oregon show as being normal in terms of precipitation, but it really doesn't take much to get us to normal. Summer is a dry season here, so while we're talking about abnormally dry conditions, we're not necessarily talking about drought right now. We had a great winter snowpack. We have water in storage, but we're keeping an eye on conditions as we move into fall and hopefully when the rains come back. I'm moving on to slide number 10. This is just a shot showing active fires in the Northwest. Many of them are in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Western Montana, and Northern California. The circle there, because I couldn't get through this little briefing without talking about the eclipse, is in the path of totality. And the National Forest has actually closed down parts of the Pacific Crest Trail and parts of Mount Jefferson Wilderness Area, where people were planning to go to watch the eclipse. So the Whitewater Fire is pretty significant. In my opinion, it's one of the most beautiful places in the entire world. So people are having to alter their eclipse plans, not just thinking about clouds, but also fire. And with that, I'll turn it over to Anthony.
Okay, thank you very much, Kathy, and good morning, everyone. I'd like to start off with slide number 11, and we'll look at the sea surface temperatures across the globe, and also the latest status of ENSO, or the El Nino Southern Oscillation. So first we have for sea surface temperatures, if you look from about the dateline in the equator over toward the South American coast, we generally have near normal sea surface temperatures in this region of the central and eastern equatorial Pacific. This is a key region because what happens here does have a large impact on what happens to the United States climate. So if we look away from the equator, above normal temperatures, SSTs, sea surface temperatures, that's not supersonic transport, for those who remember the days of the Concorde. The sea surface temperatures across the North Pacific are relatively warm, the Gulf of Mexico, the Caribbean, and also the very low latitude Atlantic. And this is very important in terms of tropical systems, for the nice warm water provides a lot of energy to any budding tropical systems. Right now we have ENSO neutral conditions, and it simply means that we are not decidedly El Nino or La Nina. Okay, if we look down at the ENSO forecast, you look at this bar graph and you can see that the green bars represent ENSO neutral conditions, and these are the probabilities as you can see on the left-hand side. So we start off with neutral, about 85% probability right through September. And then even though the odds are decreasing as we get toward the winter, we consider DJF, or December, January, February, as meteorological winter. The probabilities are still about 55% for neutral. If you look at the red bars, that corresponds to the odds for an El Nino, and you can see that that is fairly low. It only goes from about 10% at the very beginning of the period to perhaps a high of 20% by next spring on the very far right-hand side of the chart. A little bit more in terms of the odds are for a La Nina, and that's indicated by the blue bars that you see. Notice that it starts off at a relatively low, say 7% or so, and then by the time you get to the winter in DJF, we're at almost 30%. So this is becoming more significant now, and this is definitely a bit of a change from what we saw the last couple of months. So what we're applying here at the Climate Prediction Center for this winter, we think neutral conditions will continue into the winter, and then we may see some very weak La Nina conditions possible during the winter. So borderline neutral or weak La Nina is expected. Okay, so moving on to the monthly forecast for September, and let me preface this by saying that what goes into these forecasts are generally a couple of considerations. We look at a bunch of dynamical and statistical computer models. We also consider decadal trends, or those over the past decade, and even those trends that are even shorter term. And we also look at things such as sea surface temperatures. Okay, so if we look at the left-hand map on slide number, see if I can get the number on here. Well, it is on the next one. I can't see the number just yet. But you'll see that we have above normal temperatures that are indicated, and they are favored across the western lower 48 states. You can see the probabilities go as high as 50 or slightly more in terms of percentage. We also have above expected across the Northeast, the Atlantic seaboard, and also the Gulf Coast states, with the highest probabilities being favored for southern Florida and also up in Maine. And across the central part of the country, we have a very weak tilt in the odds toward below normal temperatures. And this is tied to what has been a slowly varying what we call a low-frequency signal during the past 3 to 4 months. So even though we are going for a slight chance for below normal, it is very weak, and we do think that once we get past September, as we transition into the autumn, that we're going to start replacing this signal with longer-term trends, which are warmer. So don't be surprised when you get to the seasonal maps on the next slide, and you see actually weak tilts toward above normal. It's simply a transition. We're starting off cool, and we think it'll warm up with time. Also in Alaska, historical or decadal trends, say over the past decade, strongly favor above normal temperatures, just about the entire state, with lower probabilities, often for the panhandle. However, the sea surface temperatures are quite warm around just about all of Alaska. So you see elevated probabilities for warm, warmer than normal, of course, across most of the coastal areas. And moving on to the monthly precipitation for September, you can see that we have increased odds for above normal precipitation across most of the eastern half of the country. A small maximum perhaps indicated there over the Ohio Valley. And we also have weak tilts for above normal precipitation over near the North Slope of Alaska and also across southern Alaska. So if we move on to the next slide, we have the seasonal forecast. I believe this is slide 13, and this covers September, October, November. Notice a warm pattern compared to normal for just about the entire United States. You can see that we have over the lower 48, the highest tilts for above are in the southwest, and that is largely related to trends, historical trends, also over the northeast and southern Florida. And a lot of this does come from different dynamical and statistical models that we look at. Notice there's a relative weakness in the probabilities across most of, or at least a large portion of the country east of the Rockies. And this region is generally 33 to 40% predicted for above. Again, that's what falls out through the different models that we use. Up in Alaska, between the long-term trends, also the sea surface temperatures, and for the northern slope or north slope, what we often do is see delayed ice cover onset. So it's either delayed, it just comes in later, or it might even be less than normal. But generally, that's a strong trend that has shown up in the last 10 years or so. So we're going with probabilities as high as 70 or slightly greater. For precipitation, we're going with above normal precipitation for the south central part of Alaska and also for a good portion of the southeastern lower 48 states. As we move on to the next slide, which is 14, the U.S. drought outlook, where we expect to see plenty of storm activity, cold fronts, warm fronts, low pressure systems throughout the, let's say, the Mississippi Valley and the central and southern plains. Those are the areas that are expected to see at least some relief. If you look at the legend on the lower right-hand side, anything that is in the rather tan color indicates the drought remains, but it's likely to improve by one category. The olive green color represents drought removal likely, meaning we get down to D0 on the drought monitor or nothing, you know, D nothing. Where we expect the drought to continue is, and possibly persist, is over parts of the northern plains. This has been in the making for quite a while. The autumn is typically a drier part of the year for this region, so there's really no reason to go with significant improvement in this area. The dry and hot weather that has been noted, Kathy was mentioning this earlier, across the Pacific Northwest, you'll notice that some of the drought development in yellow has been expanding westward, including parts of the Pacific Northwest. It is possible that early in the autumn, we could see some of that dryness moving into the Northwest and increasing, but the wet season is also ramping up as we progress through the autumn. So that's why we don't have any expectations of a long-term drought setting up there in the Northwest. We also have continuing drought expected across parts of the Southwest. And in Maine, we actually have improvement. We think that the drought is likely to be removed throughout the autumn. Our vegetation is normally entering dormancy during this part of the year. We get a lower sun angle, and the bottom line is that we can get reduced evapotranspiration or reduced water loss, which is very important. So the soil moisture levels may actually increase and recharge somewhat for next year. So I know it's a lot of material to cover. Hope I didn't go through it too quickly, but I think for right now, that's where the latest stands. So I'll turn it over to Brady.
Thank you very much, Anthony. And now we will now turn and take specific questions from the call participants. And if you do know who you'd like to answer the call, please indicate so. Otherwise, we'll have them decide who wants to answer. So, Sarah, can you please remind the call participants how they can ask a question and queue up the first question? Thank you.
Yes, thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be prompted to unmute your phone and record your name. Again, it is star 1 to ask a question. And our first question comes from Seth Borenstein with the Associated Press. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for doing this. This is for Jake. Looking at the global temperatures for July, NASA has it as the hottest July on record, and I believe that would make it the hottest month on record for them. Is this the am I wrong in thinking July is always hotter? So does this make it this July 27th globally the second hottest month of any month on record, or just the second hottest July? In other words, is it hotter than still all the other Augusts and Junes and I guess Septembers even? How unusual is that, and especially with the hottest land surface, how unusual is that for a non-El Nino month, an ENSO neutral month? You know, I have to ask the climate change question. And is the hottest month on record for land important or not really?
Hi, Seth. So, yes, the July is the hottest month of the year. So with our data showing July 2017 having the second warmest July, July 2017 is also the second hottest month of any month. So this outpaces any August or any June in terms of absolute temperature. Looking at the land surface temperature, so July is also the warmest month for land surfaces for the globe, so this would be the warmest month of any month for land surfaces in our period of record. And that is significant just because that people live on the land, so there are definitely more impacts in terms of, you know, individuals and businesses because that's where we're mostly located. So that is significant, looking at just the land surface being record warm for the month. In terms of, you know, climate change, you know, we are seeing an increase in temperatures over the period of record, and this is the warming that we've seen over the past couple of decades is evident in the data, and this month is just a continuation of that warming trend.
And how strange is it without an El Nino?
Oh, sorry, I missed that point. It is very unstrange. Usually our really warm months, particularly over the past decade, the two decades, have been during El Nino events. So the fact that we are not in an El Nino, which tends to increase global temperatures above the long-term trend, is unusual. The most recent years, 2015, 2016, those global temperatures were pushed higher by the El Nino. And now that we're not in an El Nino, it is unusual that we're still, you know, near record high in terms of global temperature.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Doyle Rice with USA Today. Your line is now open.
Hi, thanks for doing this. Seth pretty much asked the questions I was going to ask, but he always seems to get in first. But the main question would be, why are NASA's numbers slightly different? What is it that they use that NOAA doesn't, that comes up with slightly different numbers?
Hi, Doyle. Thanks for the question. So two points. One of the major differences between our analysis and the analysis that NASA does, if you look at the map on slide two, we don't interpolate over the poles where we don't have data. The NASA data set does interpolate over the poles. So there's some Arctic signal that we might not be picking up that is included in the NASA data set due to their interpolation. And this month was also different in the fact that we're using a different version of the sea surface temperature data set. We are going to be transitioning to ERSST version 5, which is the updated sea surface temperature data set, in early 2018. And in the NASA analysis, they made that transition this month. So two differences there that could have contributed to the differing ranks in terms of the July temperature.
Okay, thank you.
Once again, as a reminder, it is star one if you would like to ask a question. One moment, please. Again, we have Seth Borenstein with the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. Just to follow up on your answer to Doyle's question, I want to make sure I understood that right. So NASA has already started with the new sea surface temperature data set, and you haven't. Am I right? I want to make sure that's correct, right?
Yes, that is correct. We are still using the ERSST version 4, and NASA has transitioned to the ERSST version 5. We are waiting to transition in early 2018. We didn't want to change our methodology mid-year, so we're waiting until the January 2018 report to make that transition in our operational data sets here.
And are those data sets, I mean, in general, is it fair to say the sea surface data set version 5 runs hotter than version 4?
In trend-wise, the trend in the new ERSST data is actually slightly lower than the data that is in ERSST version 4. In terms of the individual months, I don't have that answer for July 2017.
All right, thank you.
And once again, it is star one to ask a question. One moment, please.
Okay, if there are, there's one more.
We do have Logan Hollers with Congressman Schutz's office. Your line is now open.
Thank you, and thanks, guys, for putting this on. This has actually been super helpful. So my boss actually represents some constituents in South Florida, and I guess my question's for Mr. Artusa. I know that you said we're going to be end zone neutral, hopefully throughout spring 2018, but with the rising sea temperatures and, I guess, service temps, are we looking at an increased prevalence in hurricanes, whether that's severity, intensity, or just the length of the season?
Hi, this is Anthony. For South Florida, that's an interesting question. We do have, for both the monthly and the seasonal, higher overall temperatures. The thing with tropical systems is that there's mostly two variables involved. The SST portion of it, or the ocean surface and the subsurface temperatures, is part of that. The other part is the atmospheric circulation and how the wind actually varies in speed and direction with height. So we call that wind shear. So there's actually two components to it. I think overall, we would generally favor a slight increase in tropical cyclone activity. I think that can be expected. Again, that's a general statement. From year to year, we may actually get some storms that comprise a below normal season. But I would add that we do look at two different things generally. The ocean is a big part of it, but so is the atmospheric shear. Because I've seen a number of times when the waters are warm enough to sustain the thunderstorm activity that goes with hurricanes, but if you have very strong wind shear aloft, all these systems will be very weak. They might only be tropical depressions or even tropical storms, but they'll be sheared before they're able to generate into a hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to consider both things. But in general, I think the answer to your question is yes, probably a slight increase can be expected just due to the warmth.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Okay.
And this is Brady, just to add in on there. Logan, if you do go on to the NOAA website, the CPC did issue an update to its Atlantic Hurricane Outlook on August 9th and did slightly increase the numbers from back in, I think, May. I can send you that link if you need it.
Yep, we've been looking at that. We're just we're holding a briefing in South Florida next week and wanted to make sure we were able to address any concerns in terms of increased severity or length of the season.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
And I guess I'll use this as the last call for questions. Again, star one if you have a question. And otherwise, I'll wrap up the call. And once, twice. Okay. And if one pops in while I'm talking, we can address that one. But so again, first of all, thank you to all of our speakers today for taking their time and giving their presentations and answering questions. And I'm going to end up by reminding you to put a few other of some other upcoming calls. So first of all, the August U.S. climate highlights and kind of a meteorological wrap-up of summer will be released on September 7th, and then the August global climate highlights will be released on September 18th. And the next monthly climate call is planned for Thursday, September 21st at 11 o'clock a.m. And again, as a reminder, an audio file of this call will be posted on the media advisory page on NOAA.gov. And then in the meantime, if you do have further questions, feel free to contact me, Brady Phillips, at brady.phillips@noaa.gov. And this concludes the call. Thank you.
Again, that does conclude today's call. Thank you all for participating. You may disconnect your lines at this time.